You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Jessica Toku Ingoa. No mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora. And welcome to The Wire for Rāpere Thursday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Beth and our new producer, Caster. Efi Akine coming up on the show for our regular catch-up with the Labour Party. Caden speaks to Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about the 2023 Pacific Islands Forum. I speak to epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker about his concerns that Aotearoa is entering a fifth wave of COVID-19. Beth, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, about the Council's consultation on improvement to Tamaki Makaurau's freshwater and community involvement in freshwater management. I also speak to Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Claire Charters, about the relationship between co-governance, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and human rights in Aotearoa New Zealand, and how our co-governance arrangement could better reflect Te Tiriti and the rights of Indigenous peoples. I also speak to volunteer at the Better NZ Trust, Rob Burney, about national support for the clean car discount and the National Party's plan to scrap the policy.
And Caster, how has your first shift on The Wire been so far?
Pretty good.
That's good to hear. We're glad to have you on board. What have you got for us today?
I speak to Professor of Environment at the University of Auckland, Giovanni Corco, about the removal of mangroves across Aotearoa and its negative consequences for the environment.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or Waia Mai Rane. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero āno hi paki hiri roki roki maurunga i ti pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho. Mihari ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Aotearoa was represented by caretaker Deputy Prime Minister Carmel Cipollone at the 52nd Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Retreat in the Cook Islands last week, alongside government-elect representative Jerry Brownlee. Caden spoke to Carmel Cipollone about Aotearoa's key focus for the meeting. Here is that interview.
What was achieved at the Pacific Islands Forum?
Certainly the strengthening of our relationships. Just meeting face-to-face makes a huge difference. We have to keep in mind that the Pacific region is hugely important. It's the most important relationship that we have in Aotearoa as a country. And so the relationships are strengthened, and that is the overwhelming most important thing.
Was climate change discussed much?
Climate change was discussed, as well as Fukushima and a range of other issues. There was certainly agreement at the table on all of the aspects in terms of the communique that we put out with respect to what needs to be our focus and what needs to be agreed upon by all Pacific nations in terms of our way forward. Certainly, we do need to recognise that our Pacific nations are really bearing the brunt in terms of climate change impacts, despite the fact that they aren't even close to being the heavy carbon emission emitters that other countries are. And so it is very intimately and urgently felt by our Pacific neighbours, and so being at the table and having those discussions was crucial.
And did it affirm anything about New Zealand's relationship with some of these Pacific nations?
Oh, certainly that it continues to be strong, and across the course of governments, it's really important that we maintain a consistent approach to how we work with our Pacific neighbours. I think what we've seen over years is a shift away from that paternalistic approach to the Pacific island countries, and that we're all equal and that we all care equally about the challenges that our neighbourhood, our Pacific Ocean, is faced with. And so working hard together to make sure that we're all on the same page.
I saw you referred to your double act at the forum with Nationals' Jerry Brownlee as Caramel Brownie. Is this true?
Well, you know, it was important that we took a collegial approach to that trip. I made really clear at the beginning that I wasn't there to scrap or slag off Jerry Brownlee or the incoming national government. It was really important to me that we work together so that we can have that consistent approach. And why not throw a little bit of banter into the mix? You know, there's nothing wrong with that. And we certainly came away on the same page and worked together really well on the ground over there.
Will we see Caramel Brownie in the future?
I'm not sure. You know, certainly I think National has been in coalition discussions, and so they haven't decided on portfolios and everything else. I'm not sure what portfolio Jerry is going to hold. And then, of course, also for us in opposition, we haven't made those decisions as well. And so I'm not sure whether you'll see that double act again or not. We just have to wait and see what happens over the course of the next 2 weeks.
We can only hope. But is it strange having these engagements during the ongoing transitionary period of government?
You know, it is a bit different. And, of course, you know, I'm going there in the caretaker role for government. I'm not there, you know, I'm in a different capacity. And so it was really important that I maintain the integrity of that. But at the same time, it certainly wasn't awkward. The vibes from our Pacific Island leaders, with the way in which they greeted, responded and worked with me, was certainly reflective of the relationship that we've built up, and we would hope that to continue.
And finally, were there any clues about what we can expect from foreign policy from the incoming government?
No, I certainly was trying to get it out of Jerry. I have to say, and he was asked by other leaders while we were there, including the Prime Minister of Australia, what they could potentially expect. And of course, Jerry was very tight-lipped, and probably would have been premature for him to be able to give his reckon, given that National Act and New Zealand First have not yet finalised their negotiations.
That is Carmel Cipollone, Labour Deputy Leader, speaking to Caden about the Pacific Islands Forum.
That was the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, recently released a fact sheet explaining the connection between human rights, te tiriti o Waitangi, and co-governance. Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Claire Charters, says the fact sheet helps to unpack co-governance arrangements in Aotearoa and how they are consistent with a modern liberal democracy. I spoke with Professor Charters about the relationship between co-governance, te tiriti, and human rights, and how our co-governance arrangements could better reflect te tiriti and the rights of Indigenous peoples. I began by asking about the importance of co-governance in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
So co-governance is important as an expression of Indigenous peoples' self-determination under New Zealand's human rights obligations. Internationally, it is important because it also gives some effect to, albeit in a very light way, te tiriti o Waitangi, which, as we all know, is a sharing of power arrangement under Article 2 and Article 1, particularly in the Reo Māori text of the treaty. Co-governance is also important because it can be a valuable tool in addressing inequality. Inequality between peoples, so as a result of the imposition, sort of illegitimate imposition of power by the colonial government back in the 1840s onwards, and also at an individual level. So research from Harvard under what's called the Harvard Project for Indian Economic Development has shown that Indigenous peoples do better on socioeconomic and other indicia when they have self-determination and can manage their own, you know, responses to their own issues. So that's really important as a sort of practical reason as well. It is also, and this takes a sort of step in between, but I think it's also potentially very important for a liberal democracy where you need to protect the rights of the minorities. New Zealand has an extremely unusual, I guess, constitutional structure and democracy in that there's no formal and robust protections of human rights in our laws. So that is in distinction to, for example, Canada, the US, and most European democracies, Western liberal democracies too.
So we would call this a social democratic approach to human rights, do you think? Or is there a decolonial aspect to co-governance?
Definitely there's a decolonization, I guess, flavour to it in the sense that you're trying to realise the rights in Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And that pre-colonial arrangement in Te Tiriti o Waitangi is a sharing of power. I'm not sure that it's especially a sort of social democrat response, maybe in the sense that it can address inequality between peoples, but that is also a liberal idea. And certainly what is more of a liberal idea, sort of a libertarian idea actually, is that the state should stay out of people's lives as much as possible, right? So to the extent that co-governance is realizing authority vesting in the people, and state out, it is actually very much a liberal idea. So I'm not so sure on the social democratic perspective, but I guess, yeah, on the inequality part, probably.
Can you explain for our listeners the relationship between co-governance and human rights in Aotearoa?
Sure. The right to self-determination and the right to autonomy and the right to sharing governance powers is enshrined in New Zealand's international human rights obligations. And that again is a very liberal idea. Human rights are very liberal in flavour of the state staying out to maximise the freedom, I guess, of individuals and also groups. It is also a way to realise particularly our right to culture, to the extent that, for example, in the Uruwera example or in the Whanganui River example, it allows tikanga Māori into the governance of, in those cases, the river and the forest. It also, as mentioned before, is a way to realise equality between peoples. So when, which is obviously a fundamental human right, right, the right to equality. So to the extent that it can address inequalities on a socioeconomic and other levels, it is clearly a reflection of, or not so much a reflection of, a way to manifest and achieve equality between individuals and peoples to some extent.
Is our current co-governance arrangement holistic, and does it honour te tiriti in your opinion?
Is it holistic? Well, no, because it's not, I guess, covering all of the places and spaces where Māori, I think, should and could be exercising co-governance. And it's not done on a sort of macro level. It's not part of a fulsome policy around co-governance, right? It's quite piecemeal, so not holistic in that sense, or certainly not comprehensive. Does it realise te tiriti o Waitangi? Not in the sense that te tiriti o Waitangi effectively allows for ongoing sovereignty of Māori and our rangatira Māori as the retention of tēnā rangatiratanga and then sharing that authority with the Crown. Co-governance is something much less than that, in the sense that the Crown retains its ultimate authority and can withdraw co-governance whenever it likes. It's part of either legislation or policy made by government. So it doesn't, I guess, challenge at all that assumption of full sovereignty by the Crown. So not fully, but maybe it's a step in the right direction.
With that being said, how could our co-governance arrangement better honour and reflect te tiriti o Waitangi and the rights and needs of Indigenous peoples and communities?
I think you can have co-governance being more comprehensive. I think you could establish arrangements that where there's a real power sharing, so that these arrangements are constitutionally not dependent on the Crown's benevolence, if you like, so that there is, you know, this fundamental constitutional sharing of jurisdiction. I think that there could be this realization and this implementation of policy and law that really provides for Māori authority over the social services that we provide to ourselves, so be that in a really meaningful way, health, education and so on. And that's not to say that in those sort of social places, socioeconomic places and spaces, that there couldn't be shared jurisdiction, or indeed more broadly. In fact, that would be appropriate, I think, in a bicultural and multicultural nation. But it should start on the premise that there is the shared sovereignty, and that is equal power or equal authority, at least in some places and some spaces.
That was Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Claire Charters, speaking to me about the link between human rights, te tiriti o waitangi, and co-governance in Aotearoa New Zealand.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
BFM and Friends are hosting the Mother of All fundraisers at Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, December 20.
Come help the Queen Bee of Auckland alternative music make some sweet honey.
Featuring two stages and an array of 95 BFM associated acts, including
Sheehard playing debut album tune in full.
Aroha.
Concord Dawn final ever performance.
Delaney Davidson and Marlon Williams.
Ebony Lamb.
Lips.
Princess Chelsea.
The Rock and Roll Machine.
Tiny Ruins.
And Voom.
Save the Bee. A 95 BFM fundraising gig. Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, December 20.
In the morning.
Tickets on sale now.
From Ticketmaster.
Take your seat at the movies and dig into Thanksgiving.
in cinemas now.
I used to love this town.
In small town Plymouth, Massachusetts, a Black Friday riot ends in tragedy, and a mysterious Thanksgiving-inspired killer begins to carve their way through residents. Directed by Eli Roth, featuring Patrick Dempsey, Gina Gershon, Milo Manheim, Addison Rae, and Rick Hoffman. There will be no leftovers.
It is going to be a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving in cinemas now.
Rated R18, graphic violence, offensive language and cruelty.
Outfield Festival 2024, the world-class independent festival celebrating music, food and art, is back for its fifth year, featuring Troy Kingy, Tiny Ruins, David Dallas, Rum Jungle, Flamingo Pear, plus heaps more local and international musical talent. Nestled in the rolling hills of Sunny Hawks Bay, Outfield Festival brings together people of all walks of life for a sweet-ass summer event. Outfield Music, Food and Arts Festival 2024, Saturday, February 10th at Te Awanga Downs. For tickets and more info, head to outfieldfestival.co.nz.
Of course, it is within this...
Hey, do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing, don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all the shushing. You people ought to be ashamed. Some of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. We'd love to hear from you.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
For our weekly catch-up with Auckland Council, I spoke to Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, about the Council's consultation on improvements to Tamaki Makaurau's fresh water management and community involvement. Here is that interview. Auckland Council has set up an online portal which Aucklanders can use to voice their thoughts about Tamaki Makaurau's fresh water and the way that it's going to be moving. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yeah, so the MPS FM, so the government direction on fresh water management, is saying, look, we've got to really up our game in terms of how we manage our fresh water in the whole country, really, but particularly in Auckland, I would suggest. But it covers, you know, rivers, streams, lakes, wetlands, very, very important, aquifers, springs, those kind of things. And basically we are consulting the community to say, look, how do we respond to this government's direction to really up our game on that? How would communities like to get involved in their freshwater management and how they can improve it? Now, that consultation's open till the 4th of December, so do jump online and check it out. There's a lot of great online resources there to help you out as well.
What might community involvement look like, do you think?
Yeah, well, from a personal perspective, I know in West Auckland we have huge, fantastic community groups here that do handle freshwater management already in a really effective way. So a good example is there's wetlands in Te Aratu, which are extremely precious on the peninsula there, and we have a community group there that look after those wetlands and encourage the entire neighbourhood of, you know, 10,000 people that do letter drops there and say, look, come and clean out some of the rubbish and come and help us with our environmental monitoring. Those kind of things. So there's really a lot of scope here for communities to get involved with their local rivers and lakes and wetlands. And I think that's something that council should really be encouraging and even resourcing if we can, yeah.
The current consultation, is the government involved at all, or is this a council arrangement?
Yeah, it's a council arrangement, the consultation. So the government sort of come in with a planning tool called a national policy statement, and they say, you know, you need to be, yeah, as I've said, upping your game in terms of your freshwater management. It's one of many kind of planning tools that they use, but they come in and say, you've got to do this. And that's cool. It's up for us then as council to respond to how we're going to actually manage our fresh water better. And yeah, as I've said, I think community is a huge part of the picture there.
Does this consultation arise in part from the damage we've seen from the cyclone? And is there sort of more urgency, do you think, to be reapproaching the issue of our fresh water?
Yeah, I think the urgency is a culmination of the sort of ongoing degradation of our waterways. And that the storm wouldn't have helped, definitely not. And the other thing is that the storm is a reminder of climate change and consistent, you know, effect on our city. So those two things relating to the storm that will have been part of the picture. But I think, you know, look, over decades we've been putting in car parks and managing stormwater right into rivers, those kind of things, and we've developed a pollution problem in many waterways that desperately needs help. And this is in urban areas as well as rural areas, where rural areas you've got livestock and things like that where that needs a certain type of management as well. So actually it's a culmination of a really desperate situation that we've been building up to for many years.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson speaking to me about community involvement in freshwater management.
The Wire. I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
In the past week, Te Whatu Ora have reported more than 5,900 active cases of COVID-19 and more than 200 hospitalisations, the highest hospitalisation rate in 6 months. But those under 30 are still not eligible for a second booster, and preventative antiviral medication is not easily accessible in Aotearoa. I spoke to epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker about why he believes we are experiencing a fifth wave of COVID-19, what may have caused it, and what we can do now to avoid further spreading the virus.
We've got a lot of surveillance systems that were set up to tell us what COVID's doing. And though the systems we trust most have changed over time, because now people are less likely to do a RAT test and report their results, and it's partly because of the support scheme that was removed in August, and there's no longer any mandates left for self-isolation. The system we use a lot more now is the wastewater testing, and this is carried out across the country, and it does give us, I think, very consistent data on what the virus is doing. And we've actually seen the numbers of detected viruses, this is basically sewage across the country, rising to their highest level since January this year. So that's a very good indicator. The other indicator that we also use a lot is hospitalizations, because it's a fairly consistent threshold for going to hospital. People don't want to get admitted to hospital, and they're not admitted unnecessarily. And that's showing our highest numbers for 6 months. And the last time we had those numbers was in our fourth wave back in April. So I think all the indicators are saying the same thing, that we are having another wave of infection. And it's not surprising, because this is how the virus behaves now in New Zealand. It's been circulating widely, the Omicron variant, for, you know, getting up to 2 years now, and we've seen these big waves of infection. I mean, they're much smaller this year than they were last year, and hopefully they'll get lower over time, but it does mean the virus is never going away. It's with us the whole time, and it's going to be peaks and troughs.
We saw that the requirement for self-isolation as well as the leave support scheme was removed in August. What do you think about this decision? Do you think that it was a mistake?
Well, I do, because self-isolation is one of the most effective ways of slowing transmission of the virus. And it is so, it's basically common sense, of course, that you're infectious for at least 5 days of this infection, probably up to 10 days in some cases. And so people should be really testing themselves before they go back to work and school. But really, I don't think anyone wants you going back to work and infecting your workmates and customers, or going to school or university, or going out socialising and infecting people around you. I mean, that's not good for anyone. And so I think that's still so important that we reinforce that behaviour. And I think it will be probably one of the lasting legacies of the pandemic, that people now think, actually, we don't want you coming to work and soldiering on when you have a respiratory illness, because it may not be COVID, it might be influenza or RSV or something else. And so this needs to be a long-term change in behaviour. But we know that for some workers, it was very hard for them to take that time off. They may have exhausted their leave. In some cases, they may be more in a self-employed situation. It's very tough not having any wage support for that period. So I think it's a pity that's gone. But we can still at least do our best to maintain that behaviour.
What have we seen in terms of numbers of people getting booster vaccines?
Well, I think that's a real gap, and that this is the number one thing that people can do to protect themselves. And we know that only about half of adults, that's over 40 years of age, have taken advantage of getting their second booster, which is really the fourth dose. And that means they're really missing out on this essential protection. And we know the vaccines are very good at stopping you getting seriously ill and dying. And so that's really a problem, I think. And this is in people over 50 who are definitely more vulnerable to getting poor outcomes. It also protects you from long COVID, not fully, but it does decrease your risk. So that's really important that we keep reinforcing that message.
How do you think we could reinforce that message and encourage more people to get their booster?
A lot of the time is basically you and I talking about this at the moment. Hopefully the message is going out to people that to check their status. I mean, many people are actually having their fifth dose or their third booster now. I know I'm like many people in that situation. And I do feel a lot safer knowing I've had my antibodies topped up with that vaccine. I think obviously promoting the fact the virus hasn't gone away, you are more likely to encounter it and you need to have that booster. I mean, the other thing is, of course, making the vaccine more available in a whole lot of settings. I mean, in workplaces and universities, other environments. I mean, everyone 30 years and over has been eligible for a vaccine, a valent vaccine this year. So I think, again, it's just making it more accessible and promoting it to people.
What other measures would you recommend to reduce the number of detections of the virus that we're seeing, as well as lower our hospitalisation rates? Could we ever potentially see another lockdown?
No. We're not looking at those kind of measures. They're not appropriate now. I mean, they served us very well in New Zealand because they delayed the arrival of the virus into New Zealand until we had widespread vaccination. And as a result, we've achieved the lowest mortality rate in the world from the COVID period. And so our excess mortality is actually below zero now. So we're the only country on earth that has been as successful at doing that, or the only country of any size. So that's really a huge achievement. But to keep those numbers down, the deaths, we do need to use all these other tools. And of course, the other measures are, paying attention to where you meet people over the, particularly over the period leading up to Christmas. Think about ventilation. Try and have gatherings and meetings maybe in an outside covered area that's going to be much better ventilated than an enclosed room. And if you are in some situations where people are very crowded and the ventilation's poor, and that's really buses and trains, that's a situation to wear a mask. Because many commuters are in a very enclosed environment for hours every week. And that is clearly a situation where a mask will be very protective.
That was epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker on Aotearoa experiencing a fifth COVID-19 wave.
Hey, I'm Paddy Gower and this is F***ing BFM.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Thank you. Celebration of her new album, Not Your Cupid, Tamaki Makaurau's Midnight Sunshine, Ernie Bell, is set to enamour audiences with an album release show at the Winter Garden at the Civic, Friday, December 8.
Ernie Bell and her powerhouse band will have you enchanted by whimsical theatre and hauntingly heartfelt song with new songs from the album Not Your Cupid.
Ernie Bell, album release show, the Winter Garden at the Civic, Friday, December 8. Get your tickets now from Moshtix.
Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
DJ Elias, Ray Dobbin and Friends of the World.
And tomorrow,
Kazen Live, followed by DJs Spliff Curtis and Martina Mack.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old collector guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jubden Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your bass lines lying around here.
Oh.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM. Let us know your thoughts on our pieces today. Text in on 5395.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
In the past year, New Zealanders have purchased a record number of pure electric vehicles at over 24,000, along with 88,000 hybrids, according to the Ministry of Transport. The new government has stated their intentions to scrap the clean car discount, along with the ute tax, from December 31st, 2023. I spoke with volunteer at Better NZ Trust, Rob Burney, about support for the clean car discount and began asking him if he believes the discount has influenced people's decision to purchase a pure electric vehicle or hybrid. Here is that interview.
Do you think that the clean car discount has influenced New Zealanders' decisions to purchase electric vehicles and hybrids?
Absolutely. And we can see this very, very clearly right from the get-go when you look at the Ministry of Transport data showing the numbers of purchases. As soon as the clean car discount came into effect, the number of purchases spiked. And we've seen that trend continuing over time with more and more energy building and more people discovering the joys of driving electric vehicles and not being shackled to the petrol pumps.
National plans to scrap the clean car discount by December 31st, 2023, along with Labor's ute tax. Why do you think the new government plans to take this approach despite clear support for the scheme?
That's a difficult and potentially politically divisive question. One could argue that one of National's talking points has very much been that people who can afford to do so will do so regardless of the cost of these vehicles. And that is possibly true among National's traditional voter base, who tends to be better off. And consequently, it might be seen as not essential for the people they are trying to advertise to in the forms of who they want to vote for them. Whereas for people who might be voting for other political parties, the Labour or the Greens, the left-wing bloc more generally, those people might need a little bit more money to be able to afford these policies. For example, we know that in the electorates in which National and ACT leaders live, these electorates are some of the most populous when it comes to electric vehicles. Clearly, people there can afford them. People around the rest of the country, maybe not so much, which is why the clean car discount is such a critical policy.
How does Aotearoa New Zealand's embracement of electric vehicles that we've seen over the past year compare with other countries?
We rank fairly well in terms of the uptake, and especially when we look at the clean car discount, we've seen the clean car discount being referred to as a gold standard policy. When you want to get people into EVs, this is the way you do it. You offer them a direct incentive and the ability to do so. Offering a charging station to somebody who can't afford an EV doesn't really do a whole lot of good in that regard. And this really follows on from the example of Norway, who have, of course, invested a massive amount of money in encouraging people to take up clean cars. And that's resulted in almost their entire fleet now running on either very low emission or completely zero emission vehicles.
Does the support for the clean car discount reflect the promise of ongoing change in Aotearoa's attitude towards electric vehicles?
I think that the promise of electrification and the promise of a brighter, cleaner future is something that most New Zealanders are grabbing onto with two hands and saying, yes, this is what we want. This is what our polling has suggested. And I don't see why anybody would want to support a move that would see New Zealand steering away from our clean, green image. This is how we like to think of ourselves. This is how we like to talk about ourselves. Well, why don't we actually do it? This policy does it. And I think we should keep it.
Why is it so important that the clean car discount continues?
Well, I think there's two elements, and you mentioned one of them earlier, the proverbial ute tax, which of course doesn't actually tax utes, it taxes high emission vehicles, regardless of what kind of vehicle they would be. The clean car discount does this in two fashions. It encourages people by saying, if you purchase a cleaner car, you either won't need to pay a fee or we will give you some money back. And it also disincentivizes people from purchasing vehicles when they otherwise wouldn't need to, by saying, if you purchase a vehicle that emits high amounts of pollution, we're going to charge you extra for that. And when you look at the amount that people are being charged, it doesn't even really reflect the amount of damage that is being done by the vehicle over its lifetime. A new vehicle, you're locking in 17 to 20 years worth of pollution. That's not really a great thing to be doing at this point in time when we're still going to be paying for that. Well, our children are going to be paying for that down the line.
Is there anything else you'd like to add for our listeners today?
I think the best thing that I would say is get out there, support the clean car discount, buy cleaner vehicles, look at how you can reduce your transport emissions by doing other sustainable things like taking public transport, walking, cycling, etc. And tell your local MPs that this is something that matters to you, that climate change is something that matters to you, and you would like to see them do something about it, something real and not just something made up. Let's take some real action.
That was volunteer at Better NZ Trust, Rob Burney, speaking to me about national support for the clean car discount.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Councils across Aotearoa have been removing mangroves for various reasons, including for aesthetics, beach access and reduced muddiness. However, mangroves actually reduce muddiness on their own, as well as supporting local ecosystems and minimising flood risk. I spoke to University of Auckland Professor of Environment Giovanni Coco about the removal of mangroves and how this can harm New Zealand's wetlands and estuaries. What is mangrove removal and how does it work?
Well, New Zealand estuaries, primarily in the North Island, are seeing a large spread of mangroves. And so around many of our harbours, people and council also have organised to actually remove the mangroves because they don't like the aesthetic effect, the fact that the sediment gets muddier when mangroves are present, access to the water becomes more complicated, and so in many places around New Zealand, mangroves have been removed, which is quite a surprising thing in worldwide terms, because all around the world there are a lot of efforts to protect mangroves because they tend to disappear. Here in New Zealand, they're actually spreading and growing much much faster than anywhere else, probably because of the large sediment input and sedimentation that they're experiencing.
Right. And so when they're removing this mangrove, how exactly does that work?
Well, how does it work? There are several tools that are used. There's just the simple cutting of the tree. They've even invented some machines, I've been told, here in New Zealand to remove them more rapidly. And then there is the issue of the roots that are actually remaining in the vast majority of cases, making the place, I don't think, particularly nice.
And so once these mangroves are removed, obviously you mentioned that there's the positive consequence that the council is looking for with the increased space. What are the negative consequences of removing the mangroves?
Yes, let's be careful. I mean, of course you have more space, but you're actually, if you're doing it because you want to avoid that the sediment in that area gets muddier and avoid sedimentation, well, our study indicates that that's the wrong thing to do, because an estuary is not just the little part where there are mangroves that we are removing, but it's bigger unit, it's bigger system. And when we look at it in its entirety, what the removal of mangroves does is it affects also the shape of the main channel, and overall it actually doesn't really affect sedimentation that much. In fact, sedimentation, our study indicates that sedimentation in the areas where mangroves were present and have been removed would actually still increase.
Right, and so if the area stays the same amount of muddy or even muddier, would that affect biodiversity at all and the ecosystems in that area?
Of course, of course. I mean, let's not forget that we are affecting the ecosystem in a major way the moment we remove mangroves. And I think there are some studies already in New Zealand that are beginning to show that there are consequences for the ecosystem, and also that actually removing mangroves is not reducing sedimentation. So that sort of confirms our study, which is numerical.
Right. So if mangroves are reducing the sedimentation, how would that work with something like the floods we saw earlier this year? Would mangroves help reduce the sediment we'd see after those floods?
Well, mangroves do actually much more than that. Actually, mangroves have the ability to slow down the water, and so they have the ability to reduce the effect of major coastal flooding. There would be a lot more flooding without mangroves. We have to be aware that they're actually helping us. And I think what our study really shows is that we have to learn to manage mangroves better. When I say better, I mean we have to manage the amount of sediment that gets into the areas where mangroves are present. If we want to reduce sedimentation, we have to reduce the amount of sediment that comes into an estuary. Let's not forget that here in New Zealand, we still do a lot of deforestation, and that means very large sediment inputs into the estuary. And that is the problem. It's not the mangroves.
Right. And so obviously there's the human risk to mangroves. Is there also a risk to mangroves from the side of the climate crisis?
Everything will be affected by climatic changes. There is little doubt about that. Mangroves will also be affected, because if the temperature changes, it also changes the area where mangroves can grow. So we might find mangroves southern than ever before at some point. They will obviously be affected, just like sea level rise will probably cause mangroves to move in upper parts of the estuaries where they're not present, they might not be present at the moment.
Were there any other things you wanted to add on to your statements about mangroves?
I think the main message of our work is that if we want to manage estuaries, we have to look not only at mangroves, but we have to look at the whole sediment budget of the system. And when we do that, we probably realize that the biggest problem of our New Zealand estuaries, of our estuaries, is the amount of sediment that is coming from the catchment areas. That is the real threat to the proper functioning of New Zealand estuaries.
That was Professor of Environment at the University of Auckland, Giovanni Coco, speaking to me about the removal of mangroves in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko ere te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That is a wrap on The Wire for Rāpere Thursday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us. Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone, Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson, Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Claire Charters, Epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker, Volunteer at Better Trust New Zealand, Rob Burney, and Professor of Environment at the University of Auckland, Giovanni Coco. Ni ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarango ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.